Okay, so we're looking at page 15, Act 1, Scene 2, about line 97. Just before we look at that, we're going to look at iambic pentameter, revise that because it's relevant to this this moment here. So just quickly, so I don't end up telling you things you already know, tell me what you remember about iambic pentameter. Five sets of two, so ten beats or ten syllabic beats a line that follow the pattern of stressed, unstressed. Sorry, unstressed, stressed, unstressed, stressed. So it's da 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 da.
It's like a heartbeat.
Yeah, it is exactly like a heartbeat. The use of iambic pentameter in Shakespeare's work serves a number of purposes. It partly serves a purpose simply for Shakespeare to show off a bit. The poetic and theatrical world of Elizabethan Renaissance England was very competitive. There was a real kind of theatrical scene in and around London, the Globe Theatre, and his ability to write so well in iambic pentameter is partly just a matter of showing off, of proving his worth as a playwright. What iambic pentameter does, though, is to mirror or echo the pattern and the rhythm of English, spoken English. And different languages around the world have different inbuilt patterns, different rhythms built into them. But the predominant pattern of English is that iambic beat, ba-boom, 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 ba-boom. And if you hear babies, well, not babies, but toddlers talk, and of course they talk in, I'm trying to think of what you call it, what do they do? They kind of, how do you describe toddlers talk? There's a word, I can't think of it. But you know, they kind of talk in words, but not proper words. They'll talk in iambic beat. My daughter, she's three now, she talks well, but when she was younger, she was classic. I've got some recordings of it. She would talk in what sounds like language, but absolutely no words at all, no proper words, just syllables and sounds, but it would have a perfect iambic beat, ba-boom, 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 because that's what her ear picked up and that's what she learned. Before she learned vocabulary and words, she learned the rhythm of speech. And so iambic pentameter mirrors the rhythm of speech, but it mirrors the rhythm of kind of ordered and kind of sensible speech, I suppose. So in Shakespeare's work, the characters of high class and high status nearly always speak in iambic pentameter. And when they don't speak in iambic pentameter, we need to be asking ourselves why. Because what Shakespeare does in his work is move away from iambic pentameter when it's of significance and importance. So rather than asking yourself why a character speaks in iambic pentameter, because most of them do most of the time, the real question is when you see a character not speaking in iambic pentameter or breaking the rhythm of iambic pentameter. And that's when you really need to sit up and take notice and ask yourself why, what Shakespeare doing. In many of his plays, it's the lower characters, the lower status characters who don't speak in iambic pentameter, or the evil characters who don't speak in iambic pentameter. So in Macbeth, for example, the witches don't speak in iambic pentameter. They speak in eights rather than tens. When shall we three meet again? In thunder, lightning, or in rain, when the hurly burn is done. Da, 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 da. It's a different rhythm to iambic pentameter. What we'll see in this play, and we'll observe it later on, what we'll see in this play is that as King Lear moves into madness and into his mind into chaos, his use of iambic pentameter, or Shakespeare's use of iambic pentameter, when he's penning his words, becomes less and less stable and more fragmented and disjointed until he ends up speaking nonsense without any kind of rhythm to it at all. And of course that echoes and mirrors what's happening in his mind. The useful thing in the edition that you've got here is that It's very easy to spot just by looking at the page when they are and when they're not speaking iambic pentameter, because they've justified to the left and the right. I can't remember what that's called. Is that cool when you do that? But you know what I mean. They've made sure that they've set it so that their left and their right justification for the text is straight. So when you look at line 97 on page 15, you'll see that that whole block is aligned to the left of the page and the right of the page, which means that there's no deliberate line breaks in there to create the iambic pattern, the pentameter pattern. Whereas if you look, if you go back a couple of pages, you'll see, if you look at the beginning of scene 2, as Edmund speaks there in the soliloquy we looked at last time, we'll see that it's not aligned to the right-hand side of the page, which means that the breaks are being put in there to mark the 10-syllable pattern. Does that make sense? So when you look at the page, you can tell immediately whether a character is speaking in iambic pentameter or not, usually anyway. So the first thing you note about Gloucester's speech here is that he's not speaking in iambic pentameter, which is interesting given that he's a character of high status, and particularly when he's being compared to his illegitimate son, who spoke just a couple of pages before and who did use iambic pentameter. It could be suggested that Shakespeare is mirroring in his use of language this idea of a world being turned upside down. The illegitimate son using iambic pentameter, the legitimate and high status father speaking in blank prose.
So say, if it goes to the end of the page, then not speaking.
Yeah. If it lines up like that at the end of the page, it's not in iambic pentameter. Because to get something in iambic pentameter, you need to press the return key when you get to the end of the 10 syllables. So it breaks up the right-hand margin, right-hand line. Okay, so this is what Gloucester says. When he found out, or he thinks he found out, that Edgar is trying to betray him, he says, "These late eclipses in the sun and moon portend no good to us. Though the wisdom of nature can reason it thus and thus, yet nature finds itself scourged by the sequent effects. Love cools, friendship falls off, brothers divide, in cities mutinies and countries discord, in palaces treason, and the bond cracked twixt son and father. This villain of mine comes under the prediction. There's son against father, the king falls from bias of nature, there's father against child. We have seen the best of our time. Machinations, hollowness, treachery, and all ruinous disorders follow us disquietly to our graves. Find out this villain, Edmund, it shall lose thee nothing. Do it carefully. And the noble and true-hearted Kent banished, his offence honesty. 'Tis strange." He exits, and Edmund says, "This is the excellent foppery of the world, that when we are sick in fortune, often the surface of our own behaviour, we're made guilty of our disasters, the sun, the moon and stars, as if we were villains on necessity, fools by heavenly compulsion, knaves, thieves and treachers by spherical predominance, drunkards, liars and adulterers by the enforced obedience of planetary influence. And all that we are evil in by a divine thrusting on, an admirable evasion of whoremaster man, to lay his goatish disposition to the charge of a star. My father compounded with my mother under the dragon's tail, and my nativity was under Ursa Major, so that it follows I am rough and lecherous. Foot! I should have been that I am had the maidenless star in the firmament twinkled on my bastardizing. Edgar, and pat he comes like the catastrophe of the old comedy, my cue is villainous melancholy, with a sigh like Tom of Bedlam. Or these eclipses do pretend these divisions. Far so la me," and in comes Edgar. Okay, so I'll give you a minute or two. I'm sure it's fairly straightforward. I'll give you a minute or two just to pick out some of the key lines. There's lots and lots in there you can quote, lots about nature and destiny and all those things. Try and pick out the lines that really seem to be doing the business, and then we'll feedback on that in a minute while I pause the recording. Okay, so let's have a look at what you've got. Who wants to start us off? Go on, Elena, and then Lauren.
When Gloucester's saying this villain of mine comes under the prediction,
yeah.
And he's talking about that, he's basically saying that his destiny has been like guided from the stars, and he thinks that this is all happening from the stars, but then Edmund sort of makes mockery of him.
Yes.
Like he says, we make guilty of our disasters, the sun.
Yes.
So he's obviously saying, take responsibility for what's happening to you, don't blame it on
Absolutely, absolutely. Which links to that theme of destiny and nature and all those kind of interrelated things. Absolutely right. Good. Lauren, what are you going to say?
Watch this. Maybe kind of the same
yeah.
thing. When he says, and all that we are even by mind trusting on.
Yeah.
Like, all simple behaviors rest upon me.
Good.
And find that I'm ridiculous.
Yeah.
And you have to take your own responsibility for your misgivings.
Good. And that's a nice quote. You're looking at, because there's a lot there you could quote, but that's a nice one. But both of those are nice quotes. And all that we are evil in by divine thrusting on. And even if you just learnt by divine thrusting on, you could use that in your essay, couldn't you? You could say, Edmund believes that it's foolishness to suggest that we're influenced, quote, by a divine thrusting on by the stars and the moon, and planetary influence. It's what I mean when I talk about revising quotes. Try and keep the quote really short, 2, 3, 4, 5 words, and weave those into your own language rather than remembering great long chunks. Because you use a lot of the available grey matter remembering for great big chunks, but it's better off used actually kind of learning the play and remembering the themes. Good. Any more to say on that? Sophia, what did you pick out?
Yeah, just the same thing, but it's quite surprising then that Edmund is sort of not in the room because
yes.
Being the engine to myself, maybe he should be more respectful.
Right.
But he says, you cause what Gloucester is talking about foppery.
Yeah, foppery. That's another great, great, excellent foppery of the world, foppery foolishness of the world. That's one of those quotes, if you're anything like me, that keeps coming back, not to do with a divine thrusting on other planetary influence, but the excellent foppery of the world, foolishness of the world. He describes it also on line 118 as an enforced obedience of planetary influence. Again, enforced obedience is quite a nice quote to learn. It's just that idea that we are somehow forced, thrusted on by the influence of the planets, the stars. And don't forget, that's all part of that telemic worldview controlled by God, that idea that destiny is not in our own hands.
You know, when he's talking about destiny,
yes.
He's talking about not taking responsibility. What is he talking about with that?
Well, the late eclipses of the sun and moon pretend no good to us. We have to imagine that in recent times there's been an eclipse of the sun, an eclipse of the moon, and he's seeing those as significant in what's happening in the kind of events around him. So he's talking about the king's decision to divide his kingdom, to banish Kent and to banish Cordelia and to trust Conor and Regan, the bond crack betwixt. We find bond crack betwixt son and father. So a son and father, but it's also daughter and father and all of those. And he's basically saying the all of these things are happening because of what has happened in the sun and the moon. Of course, if you believe that telemic worldview that all of these things are on orbs, these spheres circling the earth, and that God is in control of that, then you believe that those things affect what happens on earth. He says this, line 104, this villain of mine comes under the prediction.
Edgar.
Yeah, Edgar, who he believes to be a villain, he says he's doing this because of the planetary influence, because of the stars and the moon. It's also just worth noting the two times that he talks about nature right at the start of that speech. Though the wisdom of nature can reason it thus and thus, yet nature finds itself scourged by the sequent effect. And just a note really on Shakespeare's art as a playwright. He's written this play to be performed at the Globe Theatre and other theatres in the area, but all the same in the character, in that obviously there's no sound systems, there's no light. They're performed in the day to an audience, some of who are standing up, some of who are sitting down. Some have paid a penny to come in and stand in what would now be called the stalls, and others who have paid 2 pence or 3 pence to sit in the more luxurious seating around the Globe Theatre. Has anybody been to the new Globe Theatre in London? Oh, it's worth a visit. It's a really interesting step back into history. And some excellent productions put on there as well. But it's a rowdy theatre that they're performing to. We used to go to the theatre, and if you so much as sneeze, people turn around and go, shh. Because you're meant to be very respectful of the theatre. Quite right, too. But that's how you meant to be. But Shakespeare's theatre was very different. It was loud and noisy. This is King Lear is when it's done at breakneck speed, 3 hours on the play, on the stage, 2.5 hours on the stage. And for people standing, obviously they're not going to stand still for 3 hours. They're going to move about, they're going to shuffle, they're going to chat to the person next to them, what's going on. And so what you'll find is that Shakespeare repeats a lot of the key ideas in his play over and over and over and over. So nature, 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 blindness, 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 nothingness, nothing, nothing, nothingness. Get repeated again and again. Justice later on gets repeated. Madness gets repeated. The word, let me not be mad, Lear says several times. And it's kind of ironic in a sense that we get so into the minutiae of the detail of Shakespeare's script, his play, because an audience wouldn't have picked up on half of what we pick up on because it's spoken and it's spoken quickly and you may or may not hear it all. That's not to say it's not worthy of study, because Shakespeare wrote this as much as poetry as play. And it's clearly the work of somebody who's interested in the minutiae of his language and the way it works. But it's kind of ironic too. Okay, anything else to notice about that? I think that's... But they're really useful quotes, those, when we're talking about nature, justice, well, not so much justice, but destiny, the role of the gods, and they're useful places to start any discussion, because you've got two completely opposing but clear-cut views on the relationship of the gods with mankind, with destiny, with nature. One saying we're entirely under the thrusting on the spherical influence of the stars and the moon, the telemic system, and one saying natural rubbish, man needs to man up and take responsibility for his own actions. So they're nice kind of polar opposite views of that issue. Okay, so I'm going to stop the recording.